A thing doesn't have to be perfect to be brilliant. Hold on a second, Harlem's happening. Okay, let's go, here we go. Welcome to Casually Brilliant, a Zooms with Friends Masterclass podcast series. I'm your host, Ebony Janice. Each week for the next several weeks, I will share casual conversations with some of my closest friends and faves on various topics, including race, faith, healing, mental health, music, the metaphysical world, and anywhere else our casual brilliance takes us in the conversation. Today's special guest is Amir Suleiman. He is a poet, a healer, a thinker. I'm telling you, the casual brilliance that happens in this episode is about to blow your mind.
I'm very happy to see you too. And it's a trip because it always seems so strange. I always feel like I'm making some mistake in my memory. But when I first met you, mm-hmm. was at your Starbucks.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It seems so strange because it seemed like we would have known each other. I think even when I saw you, it didn't occur to me like, oh, I'm meeting her for the first time. It same. Was like, I haven't seen you in a long time. It was that yeah. type of thing. You know what I mean?
Same. Literally same. I couldn't, when I realized the same thing, like I got that in the middle of the conversation, like, oh, this is our first time actually seeing each other like this. It just felt crazy because I feel like we had lived in the same place a couple different times.
Right.
And all of our people are the same people. So it yeah. just was just a little amazing that, and then even for years later for me and Mona to be such good friends and yeah, yeah, like, yeah, yeah, it's like yeah. all our people are the same people.
Right That always makes me laugh when yeah. I think of you together and what a amazing pairing that you two are, although it would not have occurred to me naturally, but when I see you two together it's like, yeah, it's like a Ben and Jerry's flavor.
We
like,
need our own like, television show. We do, we really do.
That's it's what like, I'm saying
yeah
for real. Really, we should like earnestly work on that. You know what I'm saying? I think that would just be a gift to the world. I would love to tune in.
You
know, so. Yeah, yeah.
You were going to tell me just before I caught you saying something.
Oh, about quarantining.
About quarantining. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so for me personally, it's been a really beautiful thing, a gift, really. You know, I'm noting, of course, the horrible circumstances around it. And as I mentioned, my personal family dealing with right. the trial of, so I'm not trying to make small of the actual virus mm-hmm. itself and what's happening economically and otherwise with people losing their jobs and things. But in my own personal, immediate personal life, the quarantining part of it has been really wonderful because ever since I was a little boy, I like to spend time by myself. I easily entertain myself and I easily find something interesting to do or think about or engage in. So I'm never like bored. I don't really have that experience, but mm-hmm. what it's allowed for is I'm always hustling. You know what I mean? You know, it's the nature of sometimes doing what you love on your own terms, you have to be constantly just making it happen, you know? Mm-hmm. And I have to make it happen for quite a number of people. So there's a lot of people that depend on me making it happen. So it's not as easy as, oh, I'm just gonna take off, or I'm just gonna like take a break, or it's not really my choice anyway. It's not a viable option for me. It's not an option okay. that mm-hmm. I accept for myself because it's things that I have to perform and things that I have to accomplish for the sake of the people that depend on me. And with this situation, it's forced me to stop. And even if I would develop a good excuse for not stopping, it doesn't matter. It won't. None of my excuses would work.
Yeah.
And so uh-huh. it's, so actually let me make an amendment to what I just said about being responsible for other people. So all of that is true. And because of that, I've developed a way of being like I've never taken a vacation in my life mm-hmm. before. Mm-hmm. Maybe when I was a child at some point, we went to Disney World, I think, or something, but as an adult, I've never taken a vacation and I'm moving a lot, you know, because of my profession as well. And, moving around is very challenging on the schedule and on the body and the mind and so on. There's mm-hmm. on the road so many things go wrong or not as planned. And so there's a constant agility and flexibility that one has to have in their mind. And that could be like a layer of stress. So I'm either traveling, about to travel, or just coming back from travel. So now I get to make a schedule for myself, which is something new. Like, there's things that I'm going to be doing every day at the same time. I've never in my adult life done anything the same for, like, even for like a month. I've never, I'm going to do this at this time every day for 30 days. My life doesn't allow for that. Even the establishment of the prayer, which is 5 times a day. But because it follows the calendar of the natural order, meaning of the sun and the moon, the prayer even moves a few minutes every day. So like the sunset prayer, sunset is not always the same time. It changes a little. So I'm able to make a schedule for myself. And so I'm realizing now I'm kind of going to be able to find out what type of life I would live if my time was wholly my own, or if I treated my time as it was wholly my own. And so it's a time of discovery for me.
Yeah. Ooh, that it's a lot of things that you just said that that really resonates with my own experience. In that I talk about this often, actually, about how I really struggle to chill. It's the way that I was raised, actually. My dad, is an old Black man from Mississippi, and like still to this day, my dad can be on paid vacation from his job and will be like up doing stuff because he just doesn't know how to really sit down somewhere. And that had been a struggle for, like, growing up, my dad might walk past the room on a Saturday and be like, "Why are you in the bed? Where am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to be doing?" I'm a grown woman, and I might call my dad on FaceTime, and I'll be chilling, because when you call somebody on FaceTime, you're not going to be up marching up the King's Highway. But I call my dad on FaceTime, my dad will be like, "You always laying down when you call. What was I supposed to be doing, Dad?" So it really is this consistent messaging my whole life about just sitting down and relaxing. And I'm not a TV person, in that, you know, that could be a thing that you might see me sitting down doing. I remember one of my nephew, how is Deshaun? He's probably like 7 at the time, saw me watching TV one day and was like, "ATM, I've never seen you watch TV before. I didn't know you watch TV." And which tickled me, but isn't a thing that I want to teach my nephews. You know, I don't want them to think that there isn't a time where you could just do nothing. And so I have been, I say, healing from that for the last several years, because I want to know what ease feels like, and I want to really enjoy, you know, the fruits of my labor, which is the other thing that I was gonna point out that I heard you say. You were talking about how, which I know this about you, you know, you have quite a few people that do depend on you making it happen, and, you know, in your family. And, but what, I guess this would be a question, what of that feels like is for you? Like, do you feel like, because the way that you phrased it, you didn't ever say, it never was about you in the way that you phrased it. So what of that, you know, feels like it's for you? Or is that something that maybe this time is giving you the opportunity to maybe create for yourself?
Yeah, what I know for sure is, I'm going to answer what I think you're asking, but if I don't answer what you're asking, ask me again. It's funny because this is something I hear from the people that I'm responsible for, you know, where they'll say, like, because it's not like them on my head. They're not on my head. Like, "Yo, why are you making it happen?" If anything, they're more consistently on me, like, "Yo, when are you going to take a vacation?" They either came together and said, "We're going to pay for a vacation." He was like, listen, for your 40th birthday, anywhere in the world you want to go, we're going to take care of it, and you don't have to think about anything. And that was 2 years ago or a year ago. I forget how old I am.
How old are you?
I'm either 41 or 42. Anyway, for the point is, ahead of my birthday, they were like, this is what we're going to do. And I still didn't do it. So that informs me of something inside of myself. Mm. And this is why I said, Lord, let me make an amendment to what I was saying, because I could hear myself saying as if it's like all of this outside pressure causing this thing to happen. But I get my sense of self, really, by taking care of my responsibilities. It's like a fundamental part of how I define myself and the criterion that I use to measure how well I'm living or not. Mm-hmm. And I think this is very, we're going to move into some waters, because I'm also thinking about you and I having this conversation, but if this is recorded, other people hear it, because I'm going to talk very explicitly about gender.
Okay.
For me, this is intimately tied to my masculinity, my ability to produce, and my ability to protect. The people that I'm responsible for, performing in my responsibility and my capacity, is how indeed I define myself. Am I a good man, not a good man, or somewhere in between? Mm. If I fail, meaning if I'm unsuccessful, that happens. You know what I'm saying? Meaning you make an attempt at something, it doesn't go how you think. So it's not so much that I'm hard on myself, like if I fail at a particular task, or, you know, I didn't get the rent on the day it was due, but the day after or something like that. It's not so much I need to make X amount of money in order to feel like an important man. But if in my capacity and for what I have with me and my abilities, if I'm using those abilities in service of the people that I'm responsible for, that gives me, I want to say pleasure, and it is a pleasure.
Okay.
But it's even deeper than that. It's a sense of being, a sense of making good use of my existence. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's an essential part of myself. That's as a human being. And I think all human beings, well, in my opinion, all human beings should feel some of that. You don't want, particularly people you're responsible for, and this isn't gender specific, you don't want to fail in your responsibility towards people if people are depending on you. Mm-hmm. I think everyone should have a sense of responsibility to, whether it's a family member, whether it's the community, whether it's their people they work for or people that work for them or whatever. So that's generally speaking. But for me, my masculinity is really intimately tied to that. And so not doing that is strange, and I don't get it. Meaning I don't get the, what's the good in it? You know what I mean? Intuitively, I know there's some good in taking a break, or like going on vacation. Intuitively, I know that. And intellectually, I know. So I know what I'm saying sounds absurd. But somewhere in me, it's like, but you could be doing for your loved ones. Like, you could be serving. You could be. So, like, one of the things that gives me deep pleasure, deep, deep pleasure, is to see people I'm responsible for experiencing that. Mm. Like, when they chill, when I'm like, okay, you know, we've been building, now it's time for you to quit your job. And just days off, that makes me feel... That gives me, at this point in my life, this gives me more pleasure than someone saying, oh, you got a vacation, you can go to Hawaii and, you know, take a cruise, sit on a boat somewhere and
You can't even think of a vacation. Can't even think of, what do you do?
Whatever people do.
Put on a boat and whatever.
Drink drinks and eat food, whatever it is. But for me to see people I'm responsible for engaging that, like if my wife is doing that, or my mother is doing that, or my daughters are doing that, that gives me the pleasure that I think maybe other people may get from actually experiencing a vacation. But I don't know, because I've never done it before. So maybe I may do it and be like, oh, this is sort of...
Yeah, this is the life.
Yeah.
You could. I will say that, so from a different... I think definitely, obviously, it's not a gendered reality for me. I've been taught, you know, I have lived so much of my life with that messaging and that language of working hard and nobody owes you anything. And just the blueprints that, you know, my parents kind of created for me. And so much of my value for a very long time, I would still say still, but in a different way now, I think, or kind of becoming a different way now, but so much of my value for myself was connected to, I'm a go-getter, I make it happen, you know, that's just what I do. And then in 2018, my coach challenged me to start taking one day a week off, which was weird to me, because when I'm off, if I am the janitor and the CEO of this corporation, who gonna work? Mm-hmm. And then, but I started doing that, and there was something beautiful in that. But then he took it to a whole other level and was like, take a whole week off, which wasn't real to me. Mm-hmm. Therefore, it didn't exist. So poof, yeah. So I did. And I went to the Bahamas and sat on a boat and did what people do. At the beach in the sun. And I did take my computer with me, but it wouldn't work for some reason. Mm. It was like, dang, I really gotta chill for real. This is the thing that I really have to do. And it was beautiful. It really did. I got so many ideas in that time. I really realized that I wanted to shift in my work during that week off, that there were things that I had been doing that I didn't necessarily want to do the way that I was doing it anymore. And it gave me time to dream, which has become a major part of the messaging of my work. To just, like, I couldn't respond to emails. I couldn't do anything. So I had to do something with my mind, which is this always creating kind of space. And so I'm saying that to say, as my friend and brother, that you might be surprised what a little vacation will do for you, especially because I think, Amir, that the people that you find pleasure, you know, sending them on those types of experiences or allowing them to have those types of experiences, it's also like a part of, like, love is also giving people the opportunity to experience that with you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe it. Somewhere I believe it, and somewhere I disbelieve it. But I don't have a feeling of actively rejecting it, you know?
Yeah,
I don't have a feeling of that, like, this is, but I know that, because even when they were like, okay, we're going to do this vacation thing, and this has happened several times, and I was like, yes, we're going to do it. You know, by the time this date or whatever, however we're measuring it, I'm like, yes, definitely. And I get it. So somewhere I get it. But invariably, when the time would come, it wouldn't just be like a plain rejection of it. There will always be something. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, boom, I got this, or I got, you know. So it'll always be something. It wouldn't ever just be a blatant rejection of the idea. But I've never executed it successfully. I've never actually performed the task successfully. And I've been seeing, you know, journey, you know, witnessing your journey with it. And I really, really, really enjoy it. I really, like the you know, dream yourself free workshop. And, you know, and particularly, I love this for you as a Black woman specifically. And, you know, having, because, you know, some of this, like we said, is just messaging that we get just in general. And all of us have different types of responsibilities that are placed on us young and the way that we understand ourselves in the world. But there's something in the Black woman experience that I've just witnessed by witnessing my mother and witnessing my aunties and witnessing my grandmother and so on, of, I want to say this the right way, of, so for example, my grandmother, my grandfather, you know, hard worker, worked in the, you know, in the factory, long hours, that whole world, like your father. And so my grandmother was like, quote unquote, taken care of, you know what I mean? By that work. But yeah, the thing of being taken care of, like Black women being taken care of, or because obviously Black women have been taking care of themselves since forever. So it's not about a matter of ability. And this is what I like so much about what I see you doing is that it's not the ability to dream in that way and to let and to release in that way by yourself, like inside of yourself, with, because generally the structure of family and community and so on is, I believe, is originally designed to allow different aspects of the family to have that experience in different ways. So the parents are doing whatever they're doing so that the children can dream. The man is doing whatever he's doing so the woman can dream. The woman's doing whatever she's doing so the man can, whatever. So there's this dynamic of us leaning on each other. Obviously, we've had trauma on top of trauma in our affair as family. And so we don't get some of the benefits of that leaning that allows for relief. And then that serving, you know, that allows for meaning, you know? So to see you and the other women that have joined with you, and even without that structure there to support you, finding a space and really having the courage to dream like that is so inspiring and so impressive and so, miraculous, really, you know, because when you're under pressure, it feels dangerous to relax.
Yeah.
It feels like a real, like something bad is going to happen. Someone's going to die. Something's tragic. Someone's not going to be able to live indoors. Someone's not going to eat. So to be able to develop a space for yourselves while under that pressure is like Shaolin monk level, super Sufi type of Zen.
I was just about to say that it is a supernatural gift that I feel like has come to me. I remember talking about this in the early stages with Thea Monnier, and she was saying to me, who's a child of Oya? She said, Oya is in charge of the marketplace, which means, thinking about the marketplace means that there's several things, interactions, transactions happening in the marketplace. It's not just one business or one idea or one situation. It's so many things happening in the marketplace. And Oya's in charge of the marketplace. And just with her breath, just the wind, she, you know, causes everything to be under her submission. And so understanding this, like this willingness to really to surrender to the wind, you know, has been a very spiritual practice for me. I feel actually emotional, seemingly out of nowhere, but I feel almost emotional thinking about it right now, thinking about the way that you built that part of the conversation up to like resting and talking about ease and dreaming under pressure is like a what the heck do you mean kind of conversation.
Yeah.
Like, we don't have time to take a break. We got a ABCDEFG, you know, we don't have time to take a nap. We got, these kids got to eat. And so I really feel like it is a spiritual gift. I really feel like it is like a supernatural word from God to surrender to the wind, to trust, to do the work of trusting God, having to do that work and knowing that the world is on fire feels impossible some days. Like, what do you mean, you know, don't do anything? What do you mean take a nap? What do you mean take a break? And I do think about Toni Morrison, the language, or it's not just Toni Morrison, it's, you know, the legend of the people at Ebo Landing. These people got up off the ground and flew back home because they refused to be, you know, enslaved. And the way that people tell the story is that it was a mass suicide, but I really have experienced tension with that because the idea that these people decided to label it a mass suicide instead of the story that their children told, or that their family members told, or that the other enslaved Africans that were there at St. Simon's Island told, was that no, they walked back in the water, held hands, and flew back home. And so it feels like too often when we think about freedom, we do as Black people think, well, like, we'll understand it better by and by. And the by and by for us is like in heaven or in the eternal. And we don't imagine that we could actually be free here, that we could actually hold hands and get up off the ground and fly home here. That seems impossible. That seems like a fairy tale. That seems like a legend. Mm-hmm. And so people would rather label it something else, you know, as irresponsible or as a dream world, or as, instead of considering what it would look like for us to really at least try. You know, we're never gonna fly if we don't try. And so if you have this conditioned mind that taking a break means that there is no provision on the other side of that, or taking a break means that there's no liberation on the other side of that, or that if we, or even giving it a different name and not saying taking a break, but saying like, if we go and play, if we all got together today and went, well, I mean, we can't today because we social distancing, but if we all got together and decided like, let's go play kickball, what is healed in us experiencing that childlike wonder and not having to walk around for 30 minutes with the pressures of like, how we gonna eat, how we gonna survive, how we gonna stay alive?
Yeah.
And what is the Most High able to do in that moment? Just in that moment of like, okay, now that you have taken your hands off of this situation and you're distracted with ease and play and joy, like now I'm able to do these, you know, miraculous things. And I've experienced it for myself, like as a super Capricorn, you know, can be very red personality, in charge kind of woman, to for the maybe the past year or so to have worked less than I have in my adult life, and experiencing the great privilege of God's provision as a supernatural reality. It's like, okay, we might have to take this gospel on the road, because that surrender has even given me what I was saying, you know, when I was in the Bahamas, I had the opportunity to think about, the work that I'm doing is my ministry, but is this the way that I want to be doing it? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it weren't for that time of rest, of ease, of play, of, you know, I can't use this computer even though I brought it to use it, would I have had the time to really think, you know, to really think about like, what am I doing and how do I really want to serve God's people? And is it this way? Or, you know, I know that this is the message, but maybe it needs to come this way. And so I think it has to be a part of our conversation, especially as believers, because there is like a certain surrender, just the language of like the supernatural just keeps coming to me. It does feel like a very supernatural reality to be like, if I get out the way a little bit, what is the Most High able to do in that moment?
Yeah, I definitely agree. Like, as far as if the busyness is inspired by like a fear or a grieving or a distrust, you know, yeah, that would definitely be something that a person, you know, of faith would have to kind of reconcile with what they say about God, you know what I mean? You know, what you were saying was reminding me of an ayat of Quran, and I'm trying to remember where it is. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to see if I can find it as I'm talking about it. I believe it's in the chapter of repentance, actually. Mm. The chapter is called Repentance. Mm-hmm. It takes place during this verse was revealed about a battle. And Allah is describing himself as sending Sakinah meaning like a tranquility over the believers on the eve of this battle where they're grossly outnumbered. And the Sakinah was so deep, you know, and profound that the believers were even falling asleep on the battlefield. Like, they get, you know, you think of the eve of battle, like, you know, the amount of tension and the amount of anticipation, and, you know, they became so chill, they dozed off, they fell asleep. But that was described, and so this is, you know, I'm thinking of a divine nap, a supernatural nap, you know, in the context of, you know, of battle. And after that, they did engage in war. But that being the description, the way that Allah chose to give his divine assistance and the way that it was received, this divine presence, was to take a nap. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And it also made me, I'm just thinking about different times that sleep is mentioned in Revelation. So there's also Surah Al-Kahf, which is the chapter of the cave, which is also one of, this chapter is, you're encouraged to read it every Friday on our holy day of Jummah, our day of congregation. The main story in this chapter, the story of the cave, are some youth that went into a cave with a dog. As a matter of fact, I think maybe the Christians have this story as well. So they go into this cave and they have to retreat to the cave because they're testifying to the oneness of God and in a polytheistic society that they're in. They're basically driven out with a dog, actually. They go in this cave and they go to sleep. And then they wake up, it's a different time, and they come out of the cave and the whole town has been converted and all of that. But again, this is people sleeping while God is working, you know what I mean? There was another example when you were speaking that I thought about in Revelation where it'll come back to me, inshallah.
I actually was thinking, as you just started pulling, was thinking about how often Jesus was like, leave me alone. Right. Like very intentionally, we're going to go to this place, make sure nobody knows we're here.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, I'm about to go take a nap. I know that there's a storm coming, but yeah. I'm about to go to sleep. Jesus, like, just going to, you know, 40 days and 40 nights, you know, fasting and being alone in the wilderness for that time frame. But yeah, like, this very intentional language, you know, that Christ had about, like, I just performed miracles, now I'm going to go mind my business for a little bit.
Yeah. That definitely, I do that definitely. And that also in the life of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, this was the place where Revelation came, where he was in seclusion. He would go up a mountain called Mount Hira, and he would go into a cave in Hira, And before he was receiving revelation, this was his habit. And he mm-hmm. would go in seclusion, and he would come down for some time and be with his wife and society, and then he would go for long stretches of time. And so, and that's when Gabriel came to him and delivered and began to the revelatory process of revealing these words from Allah to him. And so there's definitely seclusion and the seclusion of Moses, the 40 days and 40 mm-hmm. nights and, on the mountain. Of course, Jesus, alayhi salam, likewise. And many of our most celebrated, you know, saints and people following after the great prophets, you know, we find this as a habit. I definitely, sometimes to the extreme, I definitely do that. So like fasting and seclusion, mm-hmm. in which this quarantining is, you know, kind of putting everyone in a kind of seclusion. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That especially is what I'm enjoying about this, because even when I'm doing seclusion, although I don't think of it as a vacation, but even when I'm doing seclusion, I have to put it in the right mm-hmm. space. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and put it in the, you know, I mean, even, you know, when Jesus is betrayed, you know, he's like, it's funny though, that time they can't stay awake. His disciples can't stay awake. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. He's separating from them, but he's like, yo, like,
focus, you can't say, well, you
know?
Yeah,
like, focus, and you're having trouble with that, you know?
Which I think is messaging, though, even for this moment, though, that it's not, that this rest isn't just for, because rest is many things. It's not just for during this quarantine time, just be chilling so hard that you come on the other side of this and you haven't been equipped with, you know, maybe that is intentional healing. Maybe that's, you need to be reading something, you know, whatever.
Right.
And so I think, you know, even while Jesus is like, okay, but pay attention. Like, yeah. I didn't ask you to do anything, but just watch, you know, just watch in this hour. Yeah. And,
you know, there's a poem that I have called Like a Thief in the Night. I want to quote something from it, but it's hard for me to quote like from a poem. So I'm just going to recite this poem right now, because I'm going to have to do it in my mind anyway. But it's because actually what I'm doing is I'm thinking about, I mean, it's a poem that I wrote, but sometimes I can reinterpret my own poem due to something I've learned. Like, oh, that's really what I meant, actually, even though I didn't know it when I wrote it. It says, they say the Lord will come like a thief in the night. Perhaps the Lord will come in the things that I write, in the things that we bleed, in the things that we read, in the things we recite. Maybe they're afraid I'll spit fire and these kerosene streets will ignite, or I'll spit water in these barren streets to give life. And I've learned the thing that pulls the fiend to the pipe is the same thing that pulls the human being to the light. The love of love, a means to cope. So I try to inhale their dreams and exhale hope. Homeboy said, man, the people eat the fill of the don't. So you can inhale their dreams and exhale hope, but you better chew coca leaves and spit out dope. And that reminded me of a passage, and I quote, Allah will not change the condition of a people, and today change the condition is what's within themselves, end quote. Inshallah, I won't falter, steady rock of Gibraltar, swift traversing waters, verses I've offered, I offer as a solemn sacrifice upon the altar, in order to alter the current conditions of our sons and our fathers. And they say we need more black mayors and black lawyers. I say we need more black John Mayers to win Grammys for singing songs about our daughters, because we are caught in a culture of defeatism, worshiping victims and martyrs. We are not victims, but victors, and we but witness our honor. From Style Street to Simpson Road, we are shook in the trauma of terrorism that precedes Al-Qaeda and Osama. Forget Bin Laden, Ben Franklin enslaved our great-great-grandmama, comma, great-great-grandfather, comma, indigenous stations of reservations, comma, but we caught in a coma, sleep. So this is, I got all the way to the end of the poem. This was the line I was like, the truth will have to come like a thief in the night. But being awake, I've learned, is the meaning of life. It was literally the last line of the poem. Okay, so that's what I was trying to find. So that, when I remember when I was writing this poem, I was thinking about Jesus being described as a thief. And I always thought that was a strange way to describe the Christ, right? So it was like a thief in the night. And then I was thinking, well, the night, the time of darkness, time of obscurity, and a time of rest, of sleep, But being awake, I've learned is the meaning of life. So it's not so much that, I mean, obviously night is for rest, but that the heart doesn't become blind. The heart doesn't become dark. Like the heart remains aware and open to miracles, although the eyes and the limbs may sleep. So what was making me think about that is talking about, you know, being in the Bahamas or something and you're at rest, but your heart is active and ready to witness this one who is coming in the secret of night, in the secret of rest, in the secret of sleep. This one is coming, and so to witness him or to witness it, this reality or this miracle, is for the heart to always remain awake. And sometimes the heart can become more awake if the limbs rest, that the heart can see better if the eyes close. And there's something that we can find even in this time of, you know, mass seclusion or mass, you know, social distancing, quarantining, whatever, that we'll come to discover, and I think it's already happening, I think we're seeing it, more about ourselves and more about the miracle of communion, of community, of coming together, of touching each other, of hugging each other. I think, but this is like, so in that way it's good, although it's a type of suffering, you know, because the suffering and the sweetness, like Allah says in the Quran, فَإِنَّمَا لَلْأُسْرِ يُسْرًا إِنَّمَا لَلْأُسْرِ يُسْرًا. It says, for so surely with every difficulty there is relief, with every difficulty there is relief. But the way it's said, it's like they're tied together. They're part of one of the same thing. Like one of the most wonderful experiences that I enjoy is drinking the first drink of water after fasting. And it's such a wonderful feeling. And water never tastes better. It never feels better. You feel it like down your esophagus. You feel it entering into your body, and you feel your body being like nourished instantly by this water coming to your body because it's been without it for however long. But the only way that you can have that experience is by way of thirst. Like you can't like season water in some sort of way to make it taste that way. That it requires thirst, you know? I think some of the sweetness that we're going to find in seeing each other's faces and hugging each other and kissing each other, the deep, profound pleasure that we'll have in it won't be possible except by abstaining from it. We wouldn't be able to accomplish it, you know, without the sweetness of it. So, and that way I'm looking forward to it, like a faster is looking forward to drinking.
Yeah. All the things that you just said, I know, as I'm an introvert for sure, but a thing that I've been explaining to people, because I saw all these memes like, introverts, we've been preparing for this our whole lives. That's not what it means to be an introvert. Introverts don't want to be by themselves all day long. You know, we just recharge in isolation. So I have been okay, but at the same time, I'm in a self-isolation by myself, just me and Puppy. My dog, who was just laying on my yoga mat a minute ago. And we don't do that. So basically quarantine is driving him crazy. I can imagine. He just trying stuff. Like, girl, we out here. But thinking about how much I am looking forward to all the things that you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Being able to see people and spend time with people that I maybe have avoided. Like, I live in Harlem. I avoid going to Brooklyn at all costs because it feels like out of town. I feel like I need to pack a bag before I go to Brooklyn. Like, if I'm coming to spend a night, like, this is out of town. Yeah. And so I just feel excited about, like, seeing my girlfriends that live in Brooklyn and, you know, getting out the house and going to hang out. But one thing that I am doing is I do feel like I'm being very intentional about this time here with myself, just digging deeper into my spiritual practices. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned earlier that this is the first time in your adult life where you've been able to do the same things every day at the same time. And one of the things that's been very beautiful for me about this time, despite the, you know, crisis of that's happening in this world, is I get to be in my apartment and just experience my deep gratitude for this space that I had really taken for granted maybe for the past year. And so like what it feels like to have to be here and to like just start finding little joys. Because otherwise, like, if you don't have the capacity to, like, start looking for what there is to be joyful about, it'll drive you crazy.
Yeah.
So I've been looking for things to be joyful about. And then the last thing that you said about, like, this, the suffering, there is something sweet, you know, there as well, is I certainly think about, I used to call it the Great Depression of 2011. I call it the best of times, the worst of times. It was the worst thing in my whole life. It was the greatest depression, the deepest pain, the most grief I had ever experienced. I thought I was going to die. I was confused when I woke up and was not dead. Like, I was going to die. Why am I alive? The worst thing in my whole life became the most beautiful thing. It was so good for me. I when people ask me if you could do it over and you knew exactly how it was going to happen, would you make different choices? Would not.
Yeah.
Wouldn't change one thing. It was the best. We wouldn't be here in this moment right now if it wasn't for that experience. I wouldn't be this version of myself, which I think is good. Mm-hmm. And I think that the earth was in pain waiting for me to show up. And which is what I say about this experience. There's scripture that says the earth is groaning out with labor pains, waiting for the revealing of the sons of God. And I'm certainly not one of those people that wants to make light of the fact that people are dying. And I don't think that is, you know, when we have a crisis or a pandemic, it's so easy to be like, why would God let this happen? And that's not me. I'm certainly, very aware of our human responsibility, you know, globally for this type of experience, particularly in the U.S., our government responsibility for this was happening in this country, not taking it serious and then still not taking it serious, right? Like, it's like 1:30 in the morning and the homies is out on the block. And I wanna blame them for it, but I'm also very clear that there's an arrogant assumption that everybody's getting the same information. And so I don't think that the homies are just out on the block because they don't care. I think that the information, the way that they're receiving it, is not the same as maybe the way that you and I are receiving it, which is like, to really take this serious. Yeah. So all that to say, I don't want to minimize it, but I certainly feel like the earth is groaning.
Yeah.
Waiting for us to, in this moment, in isolation and social distancing and quarantine, in this moment to be revealed. Like, who are you going to be on the other side of this experience? How are you going to be on the other side of this experience? And knowing, so I feel joy and excitement and anticipation of what that is, because I think that there is something beautiful. That's just the cycles of life. This really terrible things happen, and then on the other side of that, something beautiful somehow is able to like spring forth from that really terrible moment.
Exactly. And it's almost, it's like caused by it. Like they have a symbiotic relationship, this beauty and this suffering. And that's what that verse of the Quran is mentioning, that they're together. And, you know, there's no, any virtue that a person can think of, my kids get tired of me saying this, but it's true. But that the seed of every virtue is planted in the fertile soil of some sort of suffering, you know? Mm-hmm. So if we were to say, like, who's the most courageous person in this room? I'm in this room by myself, but I'm saying, like, in the mixed gathering, who's the most courageous person in this room, we won't know until there's danger. There's no way to know courage unless there's danger, you know? There's no way for there to be generosity except with poverty. Either that someone's gonna need the generosity, they're impoverished for something, it could be money or something else. Or, you know, if I have $1 billion and I give someone $10, it's generous, but we don't know how generous the person really is. Now, if I only have $20 and I give a person $10, then we, okay. If I only have $10 and I give a person $10, then we say, you know. But it's only because of my own poverty, the restriction of my resources, can we understand generosity or not? You know, generosity, courage, truthfulness, you can go down the line of whatever it is, and it is immediately paired, inextricably tied to some suffering, some something, some displeasure. We don't have stories of any heroes, whether fictional or historical, except that we know them for enduring something, you know? Whether it's, you know, even if it's not something tied to like an outward struggle like the civil rights struggle or something like that. But even if this person became a doctor and discovered something, the way that we tell the story is, he tried this and he tried that, he tried this and he failed and this and this and this. You know, if it's some, you know, like the I don't know if you've been watching that, the Madam C.J. Walker thing, but we're remembering her and applauding her for overcoming obstacles, and this is how she demonstrates how great of a human being that she is. And so, so then it gives a taste for, it's funny because when I started to engage, so like the last book of poetry that I released is called Love, Gnosis, and Other Suicide Attempts. And a lot of the poems have to do with this. And I had a similar experience. Actually, wow, it was around, it was 2010, 2011. So for those like few years, again, it was tragic in one way. But when I reflect on it, I'm like, it made me. Like, what people know of me and what people love most about me was made during that time. And I wrote a lot of those poems in that time. And it was really about me developing my relationship with love. And when I say love, meaning, which is the sum total of all of the virtues, because it requires all of the virtues. And so if one wants to actually be a lover, what one has to experience in order to actually, like if a person wants to be a courageous person, you're gonna have to experience danger, you know? If someone wants to be generous, you're either gonna have to witness poverty, which is a kind of suffering, or and you're gonna have to have the fear of poverty in you, but give anyway. That's how we know you're generous. And not, when I say that's how we know, it's not even like proven to other people. You can't know yourself how courageous you are. I don't know how courageous I am. I don't know how generous I am. There's tests that need to happen to know what is the limit of my generosity or courage. And so when I started thinking about being a lover and really of what it requires, I was like, "What?" There's a poem, it's not in that book, but a line from this grand poem that I'm writing about love says, if the seed wants life, it is begging to be buried. If the wick wants light, it is begging to be burned. And if you want love, you are begging for both. And I say, well, burn me and bury me so the fire can't burn me when they bury me. But this is part of a larger conversation that I'm having in the poem and about calling on the bitterness that love has to offer such that I can make myself fit for the sweetness of it. Even if we think of it in a divine way, I'm a firm believer in grace. I'm a firm believer of gifts, that Allah can give me something and is constantly, daily giving me in each moment what I don't deserve. So I'm not just saying that this is a one-to-one, you have to experience this in order to get this. But you don't find any of his prophets or any of the noble mention, men or women, except that there was something put on them such that we would know them, you know? What was put on Mary, you know, what was put on Jesus, what was put on Muhammad, what was put on Joseph, what was put on Moses, what was put on all of these people. And that's really what their story is what was put on them.
Yeah.
And then their supernatural demonstration of, mm-hmm. you know, the light in it or the sweetness in it and the goodness in it. And so I found myself leaning into the trial of what it is to be a lover. Because being a lover in truth, la ilaha illallah, people, they like the taste of the word love on their tongues, but they don't really like love. They wouldn't talk about it so in such a cavalier way. They wouldn't be talking so much about what they deserve from it. That love is designed to open the heart, but that's nice language.
Mm-hmm.
But the heart doesn't have hinges or a knob. The heart has to be broken. When we say the heart opens, meaning it breaks. This is a poem. There's no way to clothe what I've laid naked, no way to hide the burning sun. I'm nearly unconscious, barely existing. Love is pressing me out of living, out of dying. There's no use in resisting. Who would want their heart broken?
Mm-hmm.
But now the mind has been split open. I wonder who would want their heart closed ever. Mm. Can you drink from the coconut without striking it? Can you smell the incense without lighting it? There's so much sweetness and violence, so much beauty and breaking. Can you birth without bleeding and crying and screaming and dying? I've been lying, living on the outside of life, bleeding my gums against the coconut shell. Until I smash my hardened heart against harder rocks, that I learned that living is a labor, but dying is an art. And make no mistake, I'm injured, ruptured. My heart, a sweet, sun-warmed mango, split open, its juices unruly, flagrant, sultry, fragrant, insane, sacred, noble, and naked, versus like vagrants, strangers in places that were once home. I no longer have one of those. I'm nearly unconscious, barely existing. Love is pressing me out of living, out of dying. There's no use in resisting. So yeah, so you think about the coconut, that's the end of the poem. But when you think about the coconut, the outside of the coconut doesn't even give you an inclination of what the inside is. How sweet and tender and light and refreshing the flesh is and the water is in it. It doesn't resemble what it is. And the heart is like this. Most people, what they think is the heart is not really the heart, it's their husk. And not until the heart is broken are they gonna actually find what is true. But most people in the pursuit of love, they're not really pursuing love. Really what they're pursuing is there's an attraction to love, but most of their work in love is protecting their heart from being broken. But that's not the objective. And if that is the posture, then the heart won't break sufficiently in order for you to experience love anyway. And so that season for me was about the heart being bah, like that until it broke open. But then once it broke open, I was like, I had no idea what a coconut was. I didn't even know I could experience a coconut like this. I didn't know I could like sink my teeth into it and have its flavor fill my mouth. I didn't know that I could have this type of experience with the coconut.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a person that licks an orange and thinks that they're enjoying an orange. Like, yes, you know, it's an orange, but you're not tasting what an orange is for. You don't get it because you're scared of breaking the skin. Because you think an orange is designed to be whole. The orange is designed to be cut. The coconut is designed to be broken. That's the only good in it.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't break, there's no good in it. Anyway, I get excited about this particular thing because, you know, when I hear people, especially when they're giving advice, like, you know, on Instagram or things like that, and it's like, this person, you know, and obviously I'm being judgmental. I'm making a judgment about what I think about what they're saying. But it's like, you haven't, you know really what I'm judging? I'm really judging what I mentioned in the poem. When I was bleeding my gums against the coconut shell, when I thought I was doing with the coconut what I thought a coconut was for, mm-hmm. but it was a lie. So really what I'm judging in them is what I witnessed in myself and what I disliked in the time in the life that I wasted thinking I was loving, but really all I really was doing was trying to be loved. And those are two very different affairs. It seems similar, but they're very different. Being a lover and being a beloved, they're not the same. Being loved, it's very safe, and it's always pleasant. It's wonderful. It's always good, because it doesn't require anything from you. You could just be loved. The person just does the loving, and you just receive it as you like, when you like, when you don't want, how you want it. You can make whatever demands on the person, because you want to be loved like this, you want to be loved like that. You know? Okay, that's. But to love, it's scary. And this is why it's called Love Gnosis and Other Suicide Attempts, because it's like, you have to be ready to sacrifice yourself. And I'm using the word self in a very specific way. The ego self, the person you think you are, you have to be ready to slit its throat and to cast it onto the altar of love. And if you're not ready to do that, then you're not ready to love in truth. But we're all practicing, you know, we're all trying our best.
This is so beautiful though. Man, I wanted to call you out your name so many times. First of all, let me say that. You know, my natural proclivity to just grab hold of a nigga and be like, but I'm my best friend on the planet. Her name is Jessica Ralph. We're born 3 days apart. We don't know a life of not knowing each other. We're from the same place. We've been friends our entire life. Ever since we could know, you know, really know what we knew. And there have been, she is a great love of my life. When I think about love, I always think about her, because there have been times when our friendship was at the end. We came to the end of ourselves. And it was like, well, I guess we're not friends no more. Literally, the face that I'm making and the like ease that I'm saying it, it was hard, but it was always like that. We've never shouted at each other. We've never fought, never ever. Mm. My grandmother was very impressed with this when we were younger. Like, the way that y'all just had the argument, I've seen you argue before, how you know, you could be so chill with this one. But just would get to the end of our friendship and be like, well, I guess this is the end of our friendship. And then I'm thinking of one particular time, I was 30, and she told me something that was so hard. Told me about me, something that was so hard. And I was so offended and I was so hurt. And I was like, I don't receive that. And I guess this is the end of our friendship. I'm getting emotional again. And we got off the phone, like, just like that. Like, this is the end of our friendship. We got off the phone. It wasn't a full 24 hours. It didn't even take me that long to know that I was gonna call her back and figure out how to reconcile our friendship. But what the reason it took me as long to call back is because I had to die in the next, you know, like I had to be like that version of myself. If this friendship is going to survive this, I can't even be her anymore. I can't even be that person anymore. And it's, and my ego wanted to be like my host, my spirit knew that that is disposable. We could let that go. Yeah. But my ego is like, but how dare she tell me this about myself? And I had to like literally die as that version of myself before I could call this person back, who is a great love of my life, and say, okay, girl, I ain't gonna be that anymore. And when I hear you give language this way, I think about, I bring Jessica up, I bring her up often when I'm talking about love, because As a woman of a certain age who is not in a seriously committed relationship with a romantic partner, sometimes people will be like, you know, you must not be good at relationships. I'm amazing at relationships. I've been in a relationship with my best friend since we were children. So longer than some people have been married, and we've done it successfully and not ever shouted at each other and never said anything that you don't want to have to try to take back ever, never in a lifetime of friendship. Wow. And so I think about that often, because I think about the possibility, like, this is possible. It is possible to love someone who holds your world in their hand. Yeah. Like they could say this and just everything could crumble. And the type of vulnerability that has to exist in order to be able to surrender to that type of power, you know. Yeah. Yeah. And the willingness for, you know, so it's a very, that my friendship is very, it makes me very hopeful of the possibility of being inside of a romantic relationship with somebody who is, because I know we're not an anomaly. I know that other people exist who are certainly willing to be like, this is the hardest thing that I to this point, because there will come another point, because we have come to the end of our friendship more than once. You know what I'm saying? Like, there is nothing after this. We have to be born again completely in order for us to, like, if we're going to survive after this, because we could several times decided, like, I don't hate you. I love you, but this is the end of me. I cannot go any further. But the commitment that we've made in our friendship is that there is no end, that if we get to the end, that somebody just gonna have to die, or both of us, to figure out how to be on the other side of that. I know that exists, but that is painful. That is, like, it's a beautiful story to be able to tell that I've been friends with my best friend since we were children. But there are also moments when I hate her.
No, I know it. And this is what I mean when I say, when we talk about love, and because that is what, that's what love requires. It requires everything. It will require you truly love.
Yeah.
Not just like or be infatuated with, or, you know, or the kind of the game playing and all of this kind of strategy on how to, because, you know, love feels good. Being loved feels good.
Mm-hmm.
But, and it's funny. It's funny because loving feels super vulnerable. Like you said, like, I love you, and I'm offering myself to you, and you have me now, and that's deep. And being loved feels like a more powerful position, because it's like you're receiving the love, the person loves you, so on. But in truth, it's the opposite, because loving is a decision. So I can love, and no one can stop me from loving. How that love shows up, of course, has ways, but that's my decision to love or not love. To be loved is not my decision. That's the lover's decision. So although it feels for the nafs, for the ego self, it feels more powerful to be loved. Oh, so-and-so loves me. I got them, you know, wrapped around my finger. Like this type of, where a person feels like they're winning in the game of love. But in truth, they're in a more vulnerable situation, but the ego has tricked them into thinking that this is the powerful position to be in. Because they're never in control. So most of their their engagement in love is about manipulating that party to continue loving them. But that's exhaustive, and it's a waste. It's like they spend their whole mind and heart and you know, their time doing that, because in truth, they're in need. They're the impoverished one in that situation, that they need the love. But the lover, although in one way they're more vulnerable and they're exposed and they're reconciling with their own death and being reborn, it's the more powerful position, because it is, the lover is in control, you know, so to speak. But when you find two people that are lovers, meaning they're more invested and more interested and spend more time thinking about how to love than to be loved, this is when you find something really wonderful. And this is the experience that I'm having now at this point in my life, where instead of competing on like who can like manipulate the other to, it is about who can pour out more love, who can put themselves more, who is quicker to surrender themselves, who is quicker to to die. Who will, did you watch Endgame? You're not a movie watcher, I'm the Avengers Endgame with Thanos.
Yeah, I saw it.
So you remember when Black Widow and Hawkeye, they're looking for the Soul Stone and they're on that cliff and they're fighting each other? This is what I mean by love. Meaning that they're fighting to see who's going to die first.
Yeah.
Oh, you think you're going to die before me? You think you're more willing to die for me? I'm more willing to die. So on and so forth. But the one who is needing to be loved is trying to push the other off the cliff. Sacrifice yourself. Sacrifice for me. Do this and make yourself different for me and kill yourself for me. Because they're in need of love, and they're in a vulnerable. And if that lover decides or doesn't decide, their identity and their love is wrapped up on what that the person decides to do, or even what that person is able to do. You know what I'm saying? But the lover is not like that. The lover can love whether the beloved loves or not. And that's more powerful. And it's more divine. It's more godlike, so to speak. You know? But that's a hard lesson to learn, man.
Oh my God. Yes. Yes, it is. It is. And also like the to know that there isn't an end game to do that, because as I have grown on my own love journey, it's like now it's purifying. It's making sure that I'm not trying to be a martyr, you know, making sure that I'm not trying to use my selflessness to manipulate. It's making sure that, you know, so it's still like, yes, I have a ministry of reconciliation, meaning like I am very invested in, I want us to be whole. So if I gotta die for that to be the case, then I'm okay with that. But that can't be, that has to be pure. You know, my heart has to be pure when I make that decision. I can't be using that so that I could use that against you, you know, now or whatever. So it's this forever process of like figuring out how do I love my family, you know, love is, you know, we have different ways that we have different names for what we call love, but really love is love, you know, it's not, there may be other ways that you could show up in your physical self in different types of love, but it's all love. It's all the same thing.
Absolutely.
So however I'm showing up in that love, it's like just this constant like revelation for myself, like, ooh, girl, you know, like, what was that about? Where did that come from?
Yeah.
On the other side of that. So yes, it's a journey for sure.
Yeah, it's constant work, because the ego will always try, the ego will, it's so adaptive and so intuitive, you know? So yeah, like you said, it's like, okay, I'm gonna sacrifice myself, but that's really a trick to be loved. So like, you see me sacrifice myself, love me. You
know what I mean?
So it's like pretending to be the lover in order to be, I mean, I have, you know, all of the different, you know, and it's something that requires a constant vigilance, you know, a constant, and for me, you know, the whole affair of, you know, religion, spiritual practice is all to accomplish this singular task on how to love well. That's, even the beads, it's like the beads are just used to always remember, like, it's essentially, you're like, don't forget, forget, remember. I mean, that's, for all intents and purposes, what the function of the beads are, with different prayers, for different reasons, whatever, but learning how to love well, and how to be a graceful, beloved when you are loved, is the reason for life, the reason for existence, that love is the means by which Allah created the universe and the way by which Allah maintains the universe. The ionic and the covalent atomic bond are love relationships. The you know, chemistry is just a study of the relationship of different things. You know, what happens when these two things come together? What happens when they come apart? You know, physics and science and mathematics and of course, romantic relationships and family and community and art and everything. If a person can come to be a true lover and a one that dedicates their life to becoming a true lover, then this one will have, this one has accomplished the greatest thing a human being can accomplish. There's nothing beyond that. It is the absolute transcendent station of the human consciousness, soul, spirit, to accomplish true love. True love. And even if one has it for a moment, even if for a half an hour, 15 minutes, this person, this is a full life. But if a person can do it for an hour, that's better. If you can maybe a year, that's good. If a person can maintain that state, it's so difficult to achieve. If one can maintain that state, then you will have to call this one a prophet of God. This one, the ones who are able to, the defining characteristics of the prophets of God is their ability to maintain the level of love for God and whatever God made, and to maintain that state. We'll have it in moments, maybe. Everyone doesn't even have it in moments, in truth. But if you have even a whisper of it, then be very thankful. I'm very thankful, even if I can get 3 minutes in love. I said, all the work that I've done in my life to learn how to love well, if I could do it for 3 whole minutes, I would say, alhamdulillah, I've done well. God has graced me, you know what I mean? But that's it. That's it. That's it.
This is good. I love you.
I love you.
I mean it. I feel so grateful for your, for who you are. I have been learning to love people for who they are, not just for what I feel like they give to me or that they do for me. And so being able to just kind of sit back and observe people, I'm not trying to, you know, manipulate this in some way, you know, it's just like, and so that is the current space of my loving, especially as a single woman. It's like learning how to love people just in observation, because I can't put my hands on this and I can't make this be something else. So can you love right now, just in this space? And it's so, loving is such a beautiful thing for me, this current experience I'm having, because it's stretching me so much, who I am, you know, as a result of having to love, because I was called to love, you know, having to love with no strings attached. It's like a, wow, who will I be, you know, God, what? Thank you for, you know, trusting that I could be at this place in my life and that, you know, I could be called to this. So I love you, and just observing you makes me better.
And I love you likewise. And I love, like, I've been witnessing your journey. Actually, I should say now also, I really miss your preach ups. I really like those.
Me too. I miss them too.
And, you know, watching you and that journey around 2011, I was already in tune with you at that place, and watching your experience with yourself and with your femininity and with your religious life and your health and your body and Black women and the work that I've seen you, like, I'll try to describe you sometimes to someone, like, I'll mention you and then I'll try to, like, say a thing and I'll be like, yo, there's too many things, like, I don't I don't know which thing to say, you know? So likewise, just witnessing you and you know, I know the work that you do is for people, for all people. And I know it's for me, you know, as your brother. But, you know, I understand that your work is very specifically for Black women.
Right.
And so in that way, like you said, it's not like I'm loving you for the way that you're serving my individual self, but just seeing you serve in the way that you do and just witnessing it, just being, you know, a part of it, even if it's just in the witnessing, is it makes me very happy, and I'm very pleased. And as I've told you before, this is the first time just that I know that you exist, and I know that there's a Ebony Janice in the world, and doing what you're doing, it you know, it makes me sleep better. So much so I might mess around, take a vacation, go sit on the boat.
I got a success story, y'all. I convinced Amir to take a break.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Casually Brilliant, a Zooms with Friends masterclass podcast series with Ebony Janice. A new episode drops every Wednesday at thefreepeopleproject.com. Just click on the Casually Brilliant tab and get ready to be casually brilliant with me. Until next time. To support my work, you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/EbonyJanice. Subscribers at the $50 or more level get access to all content plus enrollment in my BGM Institute courses on Beyonce and African Spirit Justice and my course on Hip Hop as Liberation Theology. Plus, I have more courses being added in the coming months. Each course is an 8 to 10 week curriculum with a video lecture, and all supplemental materials are provided. Again, you can visit patreon.com/EbonyJanice to subscribe.